All right, let's jump into another deep dive. Today, we're going on location, you could say. We're diving into the world of biblical archaeology, specifically the geography of the Old Testament.
Perfect.
I'm really excited about this one. We've got Dr. Jeffrey Hewton's lecture as our guide.
And great source.
It is a great source. And we're going to use it to kind of map out, literally map out where these incredible stories took place. So first stop, the Shephelah.
Okay, so the Shephelah, you know, we're talking about those lowlands, the foothills, west of Jerusalem.
Right, between the coast and the Judean hills.
Exactly, a real border zone, a kind of no man's land.
And a battleground, right.
I mean,
that's where the Philistines and the Israelites would clash.
Oh, constantly. It was a constant struggle for control. Think about it. Every time one side wanted to make a move, they had to go through the Shephelah.
So it wasn't just about holding territory. It was about controlling access, controlling movement.
Exactly. And it wasn't just armies either. Trade routes, migration, everything went through there.
It's amazing how geography really shaped the course of events.
Yeah.
It's almost like another character in the biblical story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right there in the Shephelah, the Ilon Valley, if I'm remembering correctly, where Joshua had that epic battle, the one where the sun stood still.
You got it, the Valley of Ajalon, yeah.
Yeah.
So you can literally stand there today and imagine that scene unfolding. The Israelites are pushing forward, the enemy's on the run, and then...
boom. Daylight's extended.
Yeah.
Got rout the enemy.
That's how the story goes, and it gives you a sense of how the landscape itself played a part in these events.
Totally. Okay, so we're in the Shephelah, a land of conflict, a land of movement. What were some of the key cities there that we should know about?
Well, Gezer's a big one.
Gezer.
It was a major Canaanite city first, and then the Israelites conquered it. And then it switched hands a few times. But here's what's really interesting. Solomon, you know, King Solomon, the wisest guy around.
Yeah, the builder, the one with all the wives.
Exactly. He decides to fortify Gezer. Now, why would he do that?
Well, I guess if I'm Solomon, looking at this strategically important city right on the border,
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking trade routes, defense, maybe even projecting my power a little bit.
Bingo. It was all about control. And the excavations at Gezer back this up. You've got this massive six-chambered gate, the Solomonic Gate, they call it. It's a statement.
It's like saying, hey, I'm in charge here.
Exactly. And it's not just about defense. It's about controlling access, regulating who comes and goes.
It's incredible how these ancient cities were like microcosms of the bigger power struggles going on. So we've got Gezer in the Ayalon Valley. What about other valleys in the Shephelah?
Well, south of there, you got the Sorek Valley,
mm-hmm.
famous for its red soil, probably from all the vineyards. It actually gets its name from that, Sorek, meaning red. And this valley leads right up to the Jerusalem area.
Oh, okay. So another strategic route.
Absolutely. And it was in the Sorek Valley that you had a city called Beit Shemesh.
Beit Shemesh, right. And wasn't that involved in the story of the Ark of the Covenant?
You got it. The Philistines captured the Ark, right?
From the Israelites.
But then it started causing them all these problems. Plagues, misfortunes, the whole nine yards.
Sounds like a bad time to be a Philistine.
So they decide, okay, we got to get rid of this thing. And they send it back to Israel on an ox cart. And where does it end up?
Beit Shemesh.
Beit Shemesh, right in that valley. But here's a bit of a puzzle, though. Archaeologists tell us that Beit Shemesh seems to have been unfortified in the 8th century.
Unfortified? That seems kind of risky in such a contested region.
It does, doesn't it? It makes you wonder what was going on politically at that time. Maybe there was a period of relative peace.
Or maybe they were just really confident in their defenses. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on. What about the Elah Valley? Now, that one, I know, that's where David and Goliath had their showdown.
That's the one. Azekah was a key city there. It was like the gateway to the valley. And if you look at the topography, it makes perfect sense as a battleground.
Okay, so how would this have played out?
Well, picture this. The Israelites are camped on the slopes on one side of the valley, Philistines on the other side, and smack dab in the middle, you've got David facing Goliath. It's almost like a natural amphitheater. And get this, there's actually a site nearby called Kirbet Kaizatha, which some scholars think might be biblical Sharim.
No way.
Yeah.
So we might be able to pinpoint the location of that epic battle.
It's possible. And what's even more amazing is that Dr. Hewton shows us how we can use the geography to reconstruct the entire battle scene. You can almost see the Philistine camp, their escape route, after they were defeated.
It's like taking a time machine back to that moment. Incredible. Okay, so we've got Gezer, Beit Shemesh, Azekah, all these strategically important cities in the Shephelah. What about Lachish? I always think of Lachish and that brutal siege by the Assyrians.
Oh, yeah, Lachish. That was a major event, second largest city in Judah at that time. And the Assyrians, under King Sennacherib, they were notorious for their brutality.
Yeah, not the guys you want to mess with.
They laid siege to Lachish, and, I mean, the siege ramps, the siege works, it must have been an absolutely terrifying sight. And we actually have an artist's rendition of the siege based on archaeological evidence.
Seriously? So we can see what it would have looked like.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You can see the Assyrian army swarming the city, the desperation of the defenders. It really brings that moment in history to life.
That's powerful stuff. And Lachish wasn't the only city that suffered under the Assyrian onslaught, right? What were the wider consequences of those conquests?
Well, it was a turning point for sure. The fall of Lachish sent shockwaves through the entire region. It demonstrated the Assyrians' power, and it left other cities vulnerable. But before we move on from the Shephela completely, let's talk about Makeda for a second, possibly located at a place called Kerbet Elkom today.
Okay, Makeda. Why is that one significant?
It's a bit of a controversial site because there are inscriptions found there that mention Yahweh and his Asherah.
Yahweh and his Asherah. Now that's interesting. I thought the Israelites were supposed to be monotheistic.
Well, it's not always that simple. Especially in the early period, there was a lot of mixing of religious ideas. Syncretism, they call it.
So they were adopting elements from their Canaanite neighbors.
It seems that way. And it shows that the religious landscape was much more complex than we sometimes imagine. One last site in the Shephela before we head north.
Sure. Which one?
Tel Beit Mersim. It was one of the first major sites to be excavated in the region. William Foxwell Albright dug there in the 1920s and 30s. And Cyrus Gordon, too.
Big names in archaeology.
Oh, yeah. And there's a funny story about Gordon misidentifying an olive press as a ritual bath. Shows even the experts can make mistakes.
I love those kinds of stories. Makes them seem a little more human, you know? All right, are we ready to leave the Shephela behind and head north?
Absolutely. Let's explore the hill country of Judah.
Lead the way.
Now, the hill country of Judah, you know, it's not that different from the hill country up north. Ephraim, Manasseh, that area.
But lots of hills, valleys cutting through them.
Yeah.
Tough terrain.
Exactly. It wasn't an easy place to live. Not a lot of flat land for farming.
So how did they manage?
Terraces, mostly. They had to carve out these terraces on the hillsides to grow crops.
Ingenious. Easy. It makes you appreciate the effort they put into surviving in this landscape. So what were some of the key sites in the hill country of Judah that we should know about? What about Jib, or Gibeon, as it's known in the Bible?
Ah, Gibeon. It's a classic. You know, it's perched right on top of a hill, and even today you can see those ancient terraces. They must have been quite the sight back then, all those fields and vineyards clinging to the slopes. And of course, there's that story about the Gibeonites tricking Joshua.
Oh, yeah. They pretended to be from a faraway land to make a treaty with the Israelites. Pretty clever.
They knew how to play the game. But it also tells you something about the importance of alliances and survival in that kind of environment. Everyone was trying to find an edge.
Makes sense. Okay, so we've got Gibeon. What about Nabi Samuel? That's a name I've heard before, but I don't really know the story.
Well, Nabi Samuel means Prophet Samuel in Arabic. And it's thought to be the location of the high place of Gibeon, an important religious center.
Okay, so a place of worship, but also strategically located, right? High ground, views of the surrounding area.
Exactly. It was a place of power, both spiritual and military. And there's this tradition that Samuel is buried there, although the Bible doesn't explicitly say so.
Interesting. So a place shrouded in a bit of mystery. What about excavations at Nabi Samuel? Have they uncovered anything significant?
They have. There's evidence from various periods, including what might have been a watchtower or a small fort. It seems it was a place of strategic importance for centuries. And get this, some scholars even think this is where Solomon prayed for wisdom at the beginning of his reign.
Wow, so a site with multiple layers of history and significance. Okay, moving on. I remember Dr. Houdon mentioned a place called Tel Elful, which translates to Hill of Beans. He said that was thought to be the location of Gibeah of Saul.
Yeah, the Hill of Beans. Kind of a funny name for such an important site, right? But that's what the evidence suggests. Albright excavated there, and then later Paul Lapp. And their findings point to this being the site of Saul's capital.
Interesting. So even though it has a humorous name, it was a place of real political power. Didn't something pretty tragic happen at Gibeah as well?
You're thinking of that story about the Levite and his concubine. A terrible event that ultimately led to a civil war among the tribes of Israel. It's a reminder that even in a land considered holy, these kinds of things could happen. Human nature doesn't change much, does it?
It's a sobering thought. Okay, before we move on from Tell Elful, I have to ask about King Hussein's unfinished summer palace. What happened there? I mean, you've got this palace started but never completed, just sitting on top of this ancient site.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange sight. King Hussein of Jordan, he started building this grand summer palace on Tell Elful. Imagine, overlooking both the Mediterranean and the Jordan Valley. What a view.
Sounds amazing. So why was it never finished?
Well, the Six-Day War broke out in 1967, and construction just stopped. The workers left, the materials were abandoned, and the palace was left unfinished. It's kind of like a snapshot of that moment in time, frozen in place.
Wow, it makes you think about the fragility of peace and how quickly things can change. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. What about the Rephaim Valley? Dr. Hudon mentioned it was kind of like a breadbasket for Jerusalem.
The Rephaim Valley, yeah, it's south of Jerusalem. And it was fertile, relatively speaking. Lots of springs and streams.
So it would have been a vital source of food for the city.
Exactly. Imagine fields of grain, vineyards, olive groves, all providing sustenance for Jerusalem.
Makes sense. And it has strategic importance too, right? I seem to recall Dr. Hudon saying it was part of the Green Line after the 1948 war.
You're right. It became the dividing line between Israel and the West Bank. Shows how geography can continue to shape events even thousands of years later.
It's fascinating how these ancient landscapes are still relevant today. Okay, what about Ramat Rachel? Dr. Hudon mentioned it had a modern resort and a kibbutz. What's the story there?
Ramat Rachel. Yeah, it's kind of a unique place because you've got this modern-day community living right on top of an Iron Age site. And the excavations there have uncovered some pretty amazing things.
Like what?
Well, there's evidence of a palace or fort that dates back to the 8th and 7th centuries BC. Some scholars think it was built by King Uzziah and then later used by Hezekiah, even Jehoiakim. Remember him?
Jehoiakim. Wasn't he the one who ignored Jeremiah's warnings?
That's the one. And the funny thing is, the archaeological evidence at Ramat Rachel seems to back up Jeremiah's accusations. There's evidence of lavish gardens and terraces, suggesting that Jehoiakim was living it up while the people suffered.
Sounds like a classic case of a ruler out of touch with his people. But wait, I thought I read somewhere that there was some debate about the origins of Ramat Rachel.
Yeah, that's right. Not all scholars agree that it was a Judean site. Some argue that, based on the evidence, it might have been an Assyrian or Babylonian administrative center. It's a good example of how archaeology is always evolving, always open to new interpretations. You never know what new discoveries might change our understanding.
It's like a historical puzzle with missing pieces.
Yeah.
Okay, before we leave the hill country of Judah, I want to ask about Bethlehem. We all know her from the Christmas story, but what about its significance in the Old Testament?
Bethlehem, or Beit Lechem in Hebrew, means house of bread, and it was David's hometown. Remember that story about him longing for water from the well at Bethlehem's gate? A real classic.
Oh, yeah. It really captures the human side of David, even though he's a king.
Exactly. But unfortunately, because Bethlehem has been continuously inhabited and because of the presence of the Church of the Nativity, we don't have as much archaeological evidence for its Old Testament period as we do for some other sites.
So it remains a bit of a mystery. Okay, we've explored the Shephelah, we've ventured into the hill country of Judah, ready to continue our journey south. I think Dr. Hedon takes us into the Negev next.
The Negev. Now we're talking about a whole different kind of landscape, a challenging environment, but also incredibly fascinating. Are you ready for some desert adventures?
Bring it on. The Negev, huh? I always picture, those sweeping desert landscapes, sand dunes, maybe a lone camel wandering through. What was it really like in biblical times?
Well, it's true the Negev is a desert. It gets its name from the Hebrew word for dry, or south wind, actually. But it wasn't just an empty wasteland. People lived there, they adapted, they even thrived in some ways.
Thrived. How do you thrive in a desert?
Well, you have to be resourceful. They found ways to manage the scarce water resources, they developed unique agricultural techniques, and they used the Negev's location to their advantage.
What do you mean?
Well, the Negev was a crossroads. It controlled those important trade routes that brought spices and other goods up from Arabia and Africa.
Ah, so it was strategically valuable, even if it wasn't the most hospitable place to live. So what kinds of settlements did they establish in the Negev? Dr. Hudon mentioned Arad.
Yeah, Arad's fascinating. It's actually two cities in one. There's an early Bronze Age city, incredibly well preserved, with those unique horseshoe-shaped towers. And then on top of that, you have an Israelite citadel, probably built as a border fort.
Two cities layered on top of each other. It's like a timeline of history right there in the ground. What about Beersheba? I know that name from the Bible.
Beersheba was a major center in the Negev. In fact, Dr. Hudin called it the queen of the Negev. It was strategically located at a crossroads, and get this, it seems to have been a planned city during the Iron Age.
A planned city.
Yeah.
Out in the desert.
Yep. They didn't just throw up some houses randomly. Someone thought about the layout, the streets, the infrastructure. It shows a level of sophistication that's pretty impressive.
It really does. I guess we shouldn't underestimate those ancient city planners.
Okay, I'm picturing Ered, Beersheba. These are kind of like oases in the desert, right? But what about the Negev Highlands? That sounds even more challenging.
The Negev Highlands are definitely rough. We're talking sheer cliffs, deep canyons, extreme temperatures, not an easy place to live, even for the most hardy people. But even there, people found ways to survive, and they left their mark.
What kind of mark? Did they build settlements up in those highlands?
Well, that's where it gets really interesting. Dr. Hudon talked about these mysterious paramilitary forts dating back to the 10th or 11th century BC. They're scattered across the highlands, and no one knows for sure who built them.
Paramilitary force. That sounds serious. Who were they trying to defend against?
That's the big question. Some scholars think they were built by the Israelites, maybe during David or Solomon's reign, trying to secure their southern border. Others say maybe they were built by nomadic groups, like the Amalekites. We just don't have enough evidence to say for sure. Another archaeological mystery. I love it. Speaking of mysteries, Dr. Hudin also mentioned Kudilit Ajrud and Kadesh Barnea. But aren't those sites actually in modern-day Egypt? How does that fit into the story?
Well, borders have shifted over time. Back then, those sites were part of a region that was closely connected to the Israelites. Kuntalit Ajrud is especially interesting. It's got these unique inscriptions and drawings that tell us a lot about the religious beliefs of the people who lived there. But we'll talk more about those when we do a deep dive on 8th century sites. As for Kadesh Barnea, it was known for its spring, Ein Kedis, a vital source of water in that dry landscape.
A spring in the desert. That's like finding gold. I can see why the Israelites would have camped there during their wanderings.
Ah!
Okay, we've crossed the Negev, we've explored those rugged highlands. Where does Dr. Hudin take us next?
Eastward. Beyond the Negev, into the Arava and Edom. Now we're talking about some truly dramatic landscapes.
The Arava. Isn't that the area around the Dead Sea?
It's actually the southern extension of the Rift Valley, so it stretches all the way from the Dead Sea down to the Gulf of Aqaba. Towering cliffs, deep canyons, salt flats. It's a harsh environment, but even today, you have modern Israeli communities thriving there, like the Yotvata Kibbutz, famous for its chocolate milk.
Chocolate milk in the Arava. Who would have thought?
Yeah.
It's amazing how people find ways to adapt and make a life for themselves in the most unexpected places. What about Edom? Isn't that where Esau and his descendants settled?
That's right. Edom, which gets its name from the reddish color of the sandstone cliffs, is a mountainous region. Lots of contrast. You've got fertile highlands where they could grow crops, and then these arid lowlands that are almost desert-like.
So a land of extremes. I bet that shaped the character of the Edomites. Now, I remember Dr. Hudin talking about some really extensive copper mines in the Arava. Were those connected to King Solomon?
That's the theory. Archaeologists have uncovered these huge copper mining operations at Kerbet and Nahas and in the Timna Valley, and they date back to the 10th century BC, which is right around Solomon's time. The scale of these mines is massive, and it suggests that a powerful kingdom was behind them.
So Solomon wasn't just about wisdom and palaces. He was also a mining magnate. What kind of evidence do they have to connect these mines to Solomon?
Well, besides the mines themselves, they found all sorts of artifacts that point to a sophisticated and well-organized operation. Pottery, tools, even donkey dung preserved in a gateway. It gives you a real sense of what daily life was like at these mines.
Donkey dung. Well, that's getting down to the nitty-gritty. It's those little details that make the past come alive. Speaking of bringing the past to life, what about Solomon's legendary port, Etzion Geber? Do we know where that was located?
That's a question that archaeologists are still debating. Some think it was at Tel el-Khalifa, which was excavated back in the 1930s, but the pottery they found there suggests a later date, so it might not be Solomon's port after all.
So the search continues. Are there any other possible locations for Etzion Geber?
There's Coral Island, further south near the border of modern-day Egypt. It's got a sheltered lagoon that would have been perfect for a port, and there's some Iron Age pottery there. But we need more evidence to say for sure.
It's like a giant treasure hunt, trying to piece together these ancient stories. Okay, before we wrap up this incredible journey, I want to ask about Mount Hor. That's where Aaron, Moses' brother, is said to be buried, right?
That's right. Mount Hor, also known as Jebel Harun in Arabic, is a prominent peak in the Edomite highlands. There's a Muslim shrine there that marks the traditional burial place of Aaron. And you can imagine standing on that mountaintop, looking out over the Arava, the wilderness of Zin. It must be an incredible view, a landscape steeped in history and spiritual significance.
Wow. I can almost picture it myself. What a powerful way to end our exploration of biblical geography. From those ancient battlefields in the Shephelah to the rugged heights of Mount Hor, we've covered a lot of ground. We've uncovered lost cities, explored the stories of kings and prophets, and encountered some fascinating mysteries along the way.
And it's not just about the past, is it? These landscapes still speak to us today. They remind us of the enduring power of history, the resilience of the human spirit, and the importance of place in our lives.
Beautifully said. And to all of you listening, we encourage you to keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep discovering. Who knows what other secrets are waiting to be unearthed in these ancient landscapes? Until our next deep dive, stay curious.